I was made personally aware of the dangers of nuclear weapons testing in May of 1954. I was at that time attached as a chaplain to the staff of the Commander, Naval Forces, Far East. Our base was situated on what is known as the Sagami Peninsula, that bit of land which forms the foot, the southern foot of Tokyo Bay. All along the coastline next to our base was a network of Japanese fishing villages from which annually the important tuna-catching fleets would go out to the outmost reaches of the far Pacific. Often when the fleet was steaming in, we would travel over an excursion to these little fishing ports to watch the catch being unloaded, auctioned off, prepared for the market. In May of 1954, one of these thousands of tuna-catching ships, the Fukuya Maru, steamed into port. But her arrival was unlike that of all of her sister ships. She was not allowed to pull up at her usual quay. Her catch was not quickly unloaded. The usual crowd of fishmongers did not swarm aboard. Instead, doctors, scientists, newspaper reporters, television camera operators, these were awaiting the Fukuya Maru as she steamed into this little fishing village. For the Lucky Dragon, as is the Japanese translation of her name, had been unlucky enough to have been unnoticed within the outmost reaches of the American nuclear weapons testing site near the Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands some 2 months before. And when one of our large bombs had been detonated, several hours later a large amount of radioactive ash had fallen out on the sailors and the captain and the catch and the hull of this unlucky dragon. She had been rather highly radioactively contaminated. The fishermen who brought her home were, for the most part, sick. One of these men was destined to die. By the time that I was permitted to visit the Fukuya Maru 3 weeks later, she was much more than a ship. She had become a symbol to the world of a new and major problem which demanded our immediate attention and solution. For the Lucky Dragon pictured for all of us the need of deciding whether any single sovereign nation had the right to unilaterally decide to experiment with nuclear explosions when it was very possible that the after effects of these explosions would affect and damage citizens and peoples of nations in no way involved in the establishment of the nuclear test. Japanese scientists studying the ash which had fallen on the Lucky Dragon were able to uncode the fact that the bomb which had been exploded at Bikini was not the usual atomic weapon, but rather something infinitely more powerful, a hydrogen bomb. They forced from the United States government an admission the fact that we had detonated such a weapon. Japan has since that day been intimately involved in the struggle to bring to an end, to ban, all future nuclear weapons testing. They say that it has markedly damaged their tuna catch. The fish that they bring in each year on which so much of their economy depends has proven often to be radioactive. And they claim further that large amounts of radioactive materials come down over their islands, both from the American tests in the South Pacific and from the Russian tests in Siberia near the Arctic Circle. Their rice crop in 1956 was particularly badly radioactively contaminated. And Japan has, to a certain degree, served as the focus for all those thoughtful citizens of the world who wish to mull over in their minds this new problem. For now, we perhaps must not only struggle to bring all wars to an end, but we must ask ourselves the other question, whether nations can even begin to make the major preparations for war. When a conventional weapon is detonated, it is possible to delimit the area in which the explosion will have any effect. A wasteland is chosen, it's fenced in, boundaries are policed, and if the test is well regulated, no one who is not immediately involved in the test, no one who is not within the test site for good reason, is in any danger from the explosion. But nuclear weapons differ not only in degree, but in kind from conventional weapons. They cannot be limited by time or by space. When a nuclear device is exploded, a great amount of radioactive energy is unleashed. And this mixes with the debris and the dirt that are sucked up into the familiar mushrooming cloud. And it spirals and rises into the air. Now, the heavier particles of this now radioactive matter descend in a matter of hours, within a matter of some several score leagues or miles of the test site. This area is heavily contaminated by radioactive matter. But some of the smaller particles rise even higher into the stratosphere. They are captured there by the upper atmosphere wind currents, which move constantly around the world. And these wind currents scatter this material hither and yon over the whole circumference of the sphere of our globe, until in a matter of days, or of weeks, or of years, this matter slowly descends to Earth. It falls on all living beings, all vegetable matter, and on the Earth itself. The Earth absorbs this radioactive energy. The plants absorb it from the Earth. We absorb it as we eat from the fruit and the pulp of these plants. And in that way, we ingest some of the radioactivity unleashed half the world away, at Bikini, or in Siberia, or from the British test in the Christmas Islands. Now, it would seem to most of us untrained in physics that the amount which we would ingest and absorb would be infinitesimally small, hardly a matter for concern. So it is if we are concerned only with bulk. But unfortunately, this radioactive matter contains two isotopes which are damaging and dangerous to human physiology. The first is known as strontium-90. It is a radioactive isotope which damages the human system, adds to the incidence of leukemia and bone cancer. The second of these isotopes is known as cesium-137. It affects the reproductive genes and causes definite changes, most of them damaging, in the reproductive processes by which our human race passes on from generation to generation. Scientists are deeply and profoundly concerned with the effects of even the smallest amounts of radioactive isotopes of these two types upon the human system. Recently, last summer, our fellow townsman, Mr. Cyrus Eaton, convened a group of world-famous scientists and thinkers at his summer home in Pugwash. There they tried to estimate the possible ill effects from these two radioactive isotopes. They said that, in all probability, because of the bombs that had been detonated up to that date, that is July of 1957, there would, within the next 30 years, be a 1% increase in the number of cases of leukemia, bone cancer, and genetic damage. If we translate this into actual figures, it means that there will be approximately 100,000 men or women or children who will suffer the critical and fatal diseases implied by these names, who might not otherwise have to suffer. And none of us who have read the papers in the last few months can but know that there is a great deal of scientific debate over these figures. Some claim that they are exaggerated. Some claim that they are not sufficiently large. A layman is at a great disadvantage in these debates. But what we can say is this, that all the scientists agree to one fact, and that is that the internalization, in however small a quantity, of these two radioactive isotopes within the human body can and does damage the human system. It will take years of study and research and statistical analysis before the theoretical debate is answered. But all of us must agree that damage can and has and will continue to be done. You may have read on January 13th of this year a petition addressed to the Secretary General of the United Nations, signed by more than 9,000 world scientists, including 34 laureates of the Nobel Prize in Science, 101 members of our own National Academy of Science, and 35 members of the Royal Society of Great Britain. In this petition, the world-famous scientists cried out for an ending of the nuclear tests. I should like to read their petition to you. We, the scientists whose names are affixed below, urge that an international agreement to stop the testing of nuclear bombs be made now. Each nuclear bomb test spreads an added burden of radioactive elements over every part of the world. Each added amount of radiation causes damage to the health of human beings all over the world and causes damage to the pool of human germplasm, such as to lead to an increase in the number of seriously defective children that will be born in future generations. So long as these weapons are in the hands of only three powers, an agreement for their control is feasible. If testing, however, continues, and the possession of these weapons spreads to additional governments, the danger of outbreak of a cataclysmic nuclear war through the reckless action of some irresponsible national leader will be greatly increased. An international agreement to stop the testing of nuclear bombs now could serve as a first step towards a more general disarmament and the ultimate effective abolition of nuclear weapons, averting the possibility of a nuclear war that could only be a catastrophe to all humanity. We have, in common with our fellow men, a deep concern for the welfare of all human beings. As scientists, we have knowledge of the dangers involved, and therefore a special responsibility to make these dangers known. We deem it imperative that immediate action be taken to effect an international agreement to stop the testing of all nuclear weapons. The small nations of the world, which had no part in making the decisions to test these weapons, to a person, to a government, are opposed to their continuance. They feel that it invades their sovereignty. Each of their citizens, man, woman, and child, suffers in some way when a nuclear warhead is exploded. Now or later, each of them must pay the price. They feel that no longer can any one nation, however powerful, however large, continue to demand the right, unilaterally and of its own, to decide when and if bomb explosions shall take place, what bombs shall be exploded, and to what number. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld, spoke, I think, the will of most of the smaller nations in the world when he said on last Tuesday, "I want that these nuclear tests should cease." And even the great powers of the world, the powers which are today testing the bombs, have time and again spoken of the need for their being banned. Russia has, after all, in the last 3 weeks, unilaterally prescribed a provisional ban. 3 years ago, our own government spoke out in favor of a 2-year ban on all nuclear testing, provided that adequate inspection safeguards might be developed. The will of the world seems to be that until further knowledge has been gained as to the after effects of these radioactive explosions are known, the bomb testing should be stopped. Why then have they not been stopped? The answer, I think, lies in this. It lies in the Cold War, in the psychology of the Cold War, in the fact that we do not trust the Russians, they do not trust us. Each is unwilling to place its nuclear war potential at a disadvantage. Each is unwilling to allow the others, perhaps surreptitiously and secretly, to carry out tests and thus to gain a step, gain a mark on the other. And secondly, I think the answer lies in the fact that both the Russian government and our government and the British government are greatly concerned in developing what are known as tactical or clean nuclear weapons. That is, weapons whose radioactivity is limited and who do not pose, as today's bombs do pose, as much a threat to the enemy against which they are being unleashed as to the power which decides to unleash them. I think we can all understand the frustration of Mr. Eisenhower when he felt compelled to call the Russian ban a publicity propaganda gimmick. I think we recognize that his misgivings as to the veracity of the Russian pledge and the history of past experience may be well taken. And I think we can also understand the insistence of Louis Strauss, the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, and of Dr. Edward Teller, the scientist who has been spearheading the demand that further tests be held, in their insistence that our government develop now tactical weapons which might be useful to our government in war and would pose no threat to our own forces if they were used by them. I say we can understand their position. I do not feel that we can agree with it. For this is an age which requires not only men of understanding, but men of vision. There is a time in diplomacy for hard-headed, realistic bargaining. Bargaining which is carried out without any preconceived ideas, without any ill-considered opinion of the strength or the weakness of your opponent. But there is also a time in the conduct of foreign affairs when a nation must be primarily concerned with some higher good and must be willing to take courage and heart and gamble on some policy well conceived which may bring about that goal. There's a time in the conduct of world affairs when we must put aside the hard-headed bargaining over small and inconsequential trivia which leads nowhere, concern ourselves with fundamental issues, with the establishment of peace, the establishment of a condition of peaceful coexistence in our world. And such a time is now, and our time today cries out for men of vision. I agree with the words of Dr. Linus Pauling, Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, professor of the California Institute of Technology, who spoke in a debate with Edward Teller some weeks ago, this paragraph. The compelling need in the world today is not a need to continue the tests of nuclear weapons. It is the need to stop wasting world resources on armaments, to solve international problems by reasonable negotiation, to eliminate war, to bring morality and justice into their proper place of prime importance in the conduct of world affairs. These are the compelling needs of our age, and they will not be achieved if we persist short-sightedly in a policy only of strength, rearmament, and hard-headed bargaining designed simply to increase our power position in the world. Because preparedness alone, unaccompanied by any program designed to ensure at least that a single step, a single pillar be established in the framework of world peace, cannot avail us. Hard-headed bargaining has led us only closer to war, has led us only to the brink, tottering on a brink time and again of world nuclear cataclysm. This we cannot afford. This we must not tolerate. I applaud the words of the World Council of Churches, representing 165 Protestant and Eastern Orthodox synods, which in convention assembled last summer adopted this plank. We are bound to ask ourselves whether any nation is justified in continuing the testing of nuclear weapons while the magnitude of the dangers is so little known, and while the peoples of the other nations in all parts of the world have not agreed that they should have to bear the consequences. Nothing less than the abolition of war itself should be the goal of the nations and their leaders and of all citizens. We urge that as a first step, governments conducting tests should forego them at least for a trial period, either together or individually, in the hope that the others will do the same, in the hope that a new confidence will be born and foundations be laid for reliable agreement. This is our hope, our only hope. And our only way to achieve this hope, I firmly believe, would be to cancel now our provisions for the spring series of tests to be held in the Marshall Islands, to agree to the Russian ban, even if we are not fully convinced that the Russians had intended anything more than a propaganda gimmick in enunciating it. What have we to lose? If Russia goes back on her word, then the modern seismographic devices would quickly tell us if any major set of hydrogen or atomic explosions had been taken place elsewhere in the world. Might not we, by agreeing to that ban, force Russia to live up to her word? In so doing, might we not have contributed a major gift for the establishment of a condition of peace? Might we not have contributed muchly to reducing the health danger involved in such further experimentation? Would we not have won over the goodwill of the nations of the world, who now can see us only as a nation myopically concerned with its own national sovereignty and military posture and little else? For how can they but see us? We are the one nation of the world which has unloosed against another atomic warhead. We are now a nation which seems to be the one nation in the world refusing to accept, to be limited by, a ban on further nuclear testing. We seem concerned only with our national interests and not with the interests of the world at large. I do not believe that this is so. I believe that our government has the interests of the whole world at stake. I believe our government is a government of understanding men. I am only sorry that to this point, they have in this particular field not equally been men of vision. Amen.